no man hath ever lifted. So the veil of space hides within itself one half of the Torah. One part of the law is always revealed and the other part is concealed. And even the Ancient of Ancients was not permitted to see the hidden half of the law. Again, like Odin in the Nordic Mysteries, who was not able to read in the works of the Norns and the Fates the mystery of his own destiny. Torah rising became, so to say, the bride of consciousness. They were united in a strange, mystical, magical betrothal. And out of this union there came forth the radiant power of a new being, inwardly invested in law, outwardly invested in glory. And this new being now stood triumphant as the great archetypal androgyne, the father-mother, the Ishvara of the Hindus, the one who was able, therefore, to create totally from itself, because it had already united within itself the two great polarized attributes of space, being and existence. Torah also plays another interesting part in the story of the Kabbalah. Torah, in substance and essence, is forever concealed. But by the very act of divine creation, Torah is caused to become revealed. Therefore, that law which in its substance is hidden is in its manifestation revealed through all creational procedure. Thus, one may behold the veiled form of Torah in the mountains and in the oceans and by the shores of the sea. Torah is shown to us in the turning of the wheels of industry, in the building of our great institutions, in the laws of policy and statescraft. All of these are but the gradual revelation of Torah. For that which is revealed by the process of creation is the immense pattern of framework laws upon which creation hangs, and without which the conscious being is unable to fulfill its own purposes. We have the same again in the mystery of the microcosm. Man, coming into birth according to the Kabbalah, came into manifestation as the result of the uniting of consciousness and existence in the form of the energy fields of its parents. And where these fields met, a strange vacuum, which was actually a blending in perfect equilibrium of these two principles, formed the door through which the soul entered into generation. But once it was born or conceived, this soul begins to manifest the law. And the law of existence begins to take shape in the embryo. The law of existence begins to fashion the bones and the sinews. The law of existence, as the great architect, designs the whole strange compound fabric of our bodies, our emotions, and our minds. And finally, when man stands forth, his consciousness is still hidden, but the law that fashioned him is revealed. It is himself. Yet this law is not a being. Man does not say to his bones, "Obey me." Man does not say, "I will have them differently." Man says, "These are my bones. This is my flesh. Therefore, these are my attributes, and with these I will labor." So man accepts the pattern devised by law, brought forth by law, guarded by law. And he must go further. He must give his final allegiance to this law. For if he corrupts it, breaks it, or violates it, then the power of his consciousness to function is correspondingly diminished. This applied to the macrocosm, or to the workings of the great face, the macroprosophos, means that in the same way, divine consciousness may labor through the body which it has fashioned, but in its labors it must protect the laws of that body. For if consciousness does not protect the body, it loses the power to express itself in this area or field of manifestation. So even the power of will must obey the law of the inevitable. And the struggle between will and inevitable might almost seem to be the struggle between evil and good. For finally, the law must be good, and that which conflicts with it must be the evil. From this point, it is not entirely impossible to conceive of the struggle between will and the inevitable. It is possible to understand the rebellion of the angels and the pride of Lucifer. And it is also possible to understand the establishment of Michael as the psychopompous of the armies of heaven, the hidden God of Israel. For Michael was the archangel of the law, a form of the great power that was gradually and inevitably to be revealed in the nature and substance of Metatron, the angel of the face. In this same mystery, then, Torah, or the Great Mother, finally becomes revealed in that all parts of things which are of themselves organic, or functional, or arise from compounds which in nature are dissolvable and must be sustained by will and law. This mysterious existence becomes even more than the rainbow of Noah, a symbol of a covenant. For the fact that we are, the fact that we exist as we know ourselves, proves that we have a covenant with law. And it is also the same type of proof which, by reverse, outlaws the lawless and causes them to vanish from the face of the Lord. When, however, the law is carried forth in glory, not a glory luminous because it is constantly emanating visible splendor, but glorious in the sense that it is not necessary, as Lord Bacon says, for God to convince man by extraordinary means, inasmuch as the most ordinary means are themselves sufficiently magnificent. This concept, therefore, is that the glory of the Lord, or the glory of the law, is made manifest in all things. It is present everywhere. It is present in the growth of the tree and the rising of the sun. No exceptional glory is necessary that the law may be revealed. But the revelation of the law was given its own symbolic form. And when Torah, the mother of mysteries, had become invested in the eternal and inevitable forms of things, in the infinite diffusion of the evidences of law, everywhere operating, everywhere uniting in a wonderful symphony of coordinated purposes. When this glory strikes upon the consciousness of the mystic, when he is suddenly filled with the wondrousness of it, it is then said that the glory becomes Shekinah, and that the Mother of Mysteries is known before the face of the world as the Mother of Splendors. And the Sefer HaZohar, the Book of the Splendors, is therefore the Book of the Splendors of the Glory of the Shekinah, the splendors of the revelation of the law, the revelation of the silent mother at the root of life. Now, if we realize this interpretation of the Shekinah, we shall know why it stood as a column of smoke by day and a pillar of flame by night, and how it led the children of Israel out of bondage across the mysteries of the Red Sea and finally to the Promised Land. The glory of the Shekinah was the covenant, the proof that the way of Israel was a way of righteousness, and that the children of Israel were obedient unto the Lord. This glory of the Shekinah, according to the medieval Kabbalists, is peace among the peoples of the earth. It is the good crop rising from the ground. It is fertility, the laughter of children. The Shekinah is faithful men, not only bending their heads in prayer, but bending their backs side by side in the service of each other and the common good. The glory of the Shekinah is that peace, order, tranquility, by means of which is revealed that people have kept the law. Therefore, happiness is a form of the Shekinah's radiance, reserved for those who have fulfilled the doctrines which are of old. If, however, man breaks his covenant, then the Shekinah's glory fades, and man wanders in darkness and in the desert of waiting, and he knows not where to go, for the face of the Lord is turned from him, and he dwells in evil. This symbolism, while again it is rather a poetical extension of ideas, suggests more meat than might first appear. It suggests a relationship in life between the individual who plays now the part of God and the inevitable with which he is surrounded and to a large degree permeated. That man is truly not a free agent, nor was God. Both God and man have a power of limited determinism, and this power gives to each the right to use the law, to use this infinite supply, which corresponds very strongly in the early symbolism of the building of the everlasting house, as a strange and wonderful reminder that Solomon, the Lord of Israel, played the part of the great Jehovah God, and the mysterious friend, Hiram, king of Tyre, who joined him in this undertaking, symbolizes the mystery of the concealed pattern, the Torah, whereas the architect of the temple was the revealed law, moving into objective manifestation and building the house according to the law. So the great one of antiquity, the ancient face, built the house of existence in existence, built the house of his own being according to the law. And because it was built according to the law, it was acceptable before the law, and the living God dwelt therein. This concept, therefore, points out several important situations of which I think Buddhism adds a certain clarifying note. Actually, if law is in the ultimate, superior, and in its own nature, totally suspended, then in the Kabbalah we can understand why even the Great One, the Holy of Holy Ones, could demand nothing of the law, but could only entreat it, could come to it only requesting a favor. And the law rising before the face of the Ancient One did not reveal her face even to God, but spoke from the strange veils that concealed her nature, and her voice was as an oracle. And she said unto the Ancient of Ancients, "It is not meet nor seemly that a great king should be without a kingdom." This was the statement of the law. And by the power of the law, therefore, the Holy One was empowered to bring forth his world, to set forth his generations, much as in the story of the Greek creation myths of Hesiod and the Orphic theology. Therefore, with the sanction of the law, the Great One brought forth his kingdom. And because the law was forever veiled and concealed in its own essence and substance, it is also said in the Kabbalah that when the streams and the rivers mingle, who shall know the compound? That in this great process of creation itself, the operations of law became so strange and mysterious that the mind of neither God nor man could fully comprehend them, because the law was infinite, and all minds must be in some way finite. The law was infinite, and even consciousness, because it was consciousness, could not be unconsciousness, therefore could not be complete. Therefore, light, by its very nature, cannot be darkness, and the mysteries of the darkness cannot be known to the light. For wherever the light goes, it hides the darkness from itself. Now, this is a very interesting point, for it tells us, therefore, or causes us to come to the comprehension that in the processes of creation, the mystery of the interaction of consciousness and existence, universal will and law, resulted in a series of intermediate conditions, conditions in which one condition imposed itself upon another. The attributes of one law impinged upon the manifestations of other laws. And there arose a vast net of lawfulness. This net was not evil, but it was the strange interweaving of infinite law in its infinite manifestation. And this strange and wonderful interweaving brought with it a strange complexity in which life itself could not quickly untangle the threads of this snarl of cosmic process. So that even man today, where the analogy is always brought back to man in the Kabbalah, that man himself, though of the greatest righteousness and of most saintly nature, even Moses himself, could not in all things keep the law. Therefore, being unable to fully comprehend that which was in excess of its own comprehension, man inherited the mystery of death. For death is merely the ultimate incapacity of the conscious being to achieve an absolute harmony with the eternal pattern. Thus all things, by falling short of the law, fall short of their own survival or of their own continuing existence. And through their falling short of their own perfection, they are therefore subject to the infirmities of imperfection. And this is no reflection upon either God nor man, but the simple insistence of the Kabbalist that both gods and men are laboring with an infinite that is ultimately unknowable. But that this infinite, instead of being a person hiding knowledge, or a being suppressing its own good, is a vast network of available energies by means of which creating powers on all levels, whether a god creating a universe or a musician writing a song, all these things come out of this infinite reservoir of potential. But there is no being that knows the end and substance of this reservoir. Therefore, there is no being that can absolutely and certainly and infallibly determine the ultimate purpose of law. This is concealed within its own inevitable nature, and its veil no man can raise. The path of virtue, in the Kabbalistic way of thinking, is therefore the path of gradually increasing intelligent cooperation with law. It accepts the absolute autocracy, not of an arbitrary deity who hardened Pharaoh's heart, but of a principle beyond which there can be no appeal, the absolute existence with law coeternal with and in itself. This, then, out of law, is the infinite productivity. All forms emerge from law. All patterns, devices, structures arise from law. Both the body of God, which is creation, and the body of man, which is the microcosm. Because, therefore, this existence is the womb of all things, it is the great mother. For all seems to come forth from her, and abiding its time returns to her again. Most ancient peoples had this belief, and they regarded the mother principle not merely as negative or matter, but as the infinite world-bearing existence within which the seed of conscious being was sowed and brought forth the vast majesty of the cosmos. Now, what does this have to say in terms of modern thinking? Do we have hold of anything that might be valuable to us? Is there a reason, for example, why we should differentiate between atomic energy and God? Is there any reason to assume that this vast exploration of space has as its ultimate end the discovery of a being? Or has this exploration for its assumed end the realization of the dramatic archetypal pattern of inevitables by which all things are governed? Has this modern search, therefore, on a scientific level, revealed to us certain, we'll say, aspects or attributes of an interlocking structure of inevitable principles that cannot be violated? The violation of these principles is a sin against law and, in a sense, a crime against man. This violation of principles is also a continuing detriment to universal consciousness. Universal consciousness, however, according to the Kabbalah, cannot step in and by a gentle gesture of its spiritual scepter nullify man's violation of law. The Kabbalah, therefore, now has at least a working hypothesis to explain why deity cannot suddenly terminate the lawless state of man. Now, a big theological situation can be built upon this. It becomes the only reasonable answer that the old Kabbalists, at least, could devise, for it was the only answer which did not compromise the essential goodness of deity, did not in any way reflect upon the reality of virtue, and at the same time did not cater to any form of the delinquencies of created things. This concept sort of left everything honest. It did, however, achieve this end by assuming that there was a pattern co-eternal with God and not identical with God. The anthropomorphism raises its head again, but of course in a very highly abstract way. We know that Buddhism, of all the religions in the world, laid the greatest stress upon law. Buddhism went almost so far that one or two Western scholars have said, Buddhism has no God, but if there is anything that may be likened to a God in the general reverence of Buddhists, it is law. For them, law is that which God is to the followers of theistic faiths. Buddha made a great point of the complete and total obedience to law. In this, he broke from Brahmanism and the worship of the Hindic divinities. Brahma appears in Buddhism, but in a subsidiary capacity. Brahma as deity and as consciousness in space in Buddhism is subject to law, which of course is an interesting phase of Eastern religion. But ultimate release is not found by pleasing God, but by obeying law. Only in this obedience can truth be achieved. But the byproduct of the obedience to law is that deity is glorified and made satisfied. Therefore, man adds to the glory of God by obeying the law. This would be very similar to the Kabbalistic position. Buddha now also goes on to explain that involvement in law is existence as we know it, and that the Sun, as the being, becomes disentangled from the mysterious interoperation of the skandhas, this being slowly disappears. Being as we know it, then, is a network of laws, and man exists only to the degree that he is unable to fulfill the law. Existence in Buddhism, therefore, is a condition of inadequacy. Because if everything is brought to a state of absolute harmony, existence as we know it disappears. Therefore, in Buddhism, we might assume that consciousness corresponds to God. Law corresponds to the Torah or the Great Mother. And when these are brought into equilibrium, universal existence as we know it is suspended. Consciousness and existence are returned to their primordial states, the state in which they have dwelt prior to the creation of a world. In the suspension of these two, therefore, there is not the reestablishment of a one God theory, but there is a return of consciousness to the field of law, where it remains until such other time as it is called forth again. In the Kabbalah, consciousness is of a nature different from law, in this, that consciousness is an evolving being, and through infinite manifestations, from the least to the greatest, it has grown up in space like a great tree. If this tree shall die or fall, then from its acorns new trees will rise, and the growth of the forest goes on forever. And the forest is composed of living beings. But the earth in which the roots of these beings gain their nutrition, this earth is law. The dark mother, the invisible provider, the sustainer, that becomes benevolent when benevolently entreated. But when certain conditions arise, ceases its benevolence. When law ceases its support, the thing perishes. But law does not perish. Life as living beings, however, as populations of space, must go on. Their bodies, governed by law, return to the law from whence they came, disintegrated by the conflict between consciousness and law. But the consciousness itself goes on its way of unfoldment within law. And this consciousness, by an infinite process of evolution, becomes an eternal being, continuing in an eternal state. The being is alive. The state is life. And this difference might offer a number of escapes from some of the scientific dilemmas of our day. For we now do recognize what the Buddhist also held to be true, namely that consciousness itself has a kind of nature which is a product of relationships and of values, but at a root consciousness, unknowable to the objective sense, also has a kind of seed existence beyond our knowing. Beings return to being. Things return to existence. Now, everything is composed of beings, and every being is invested in things. The pattern is immensely complicated and involved, but the separation of forms by the various decays and disintegrations of existence is merely the clarification of basic classifications. Existence claims that which it engenders. Being calls for that which it gave. Therefore, all existence returns to the principle of existence. All living things to the principle or being of living things. In primitive times, our remote ancestors described this situation as return to God and nature. And in the funeral service, we say that we return to the earth that which belongs to the earth, and to God that which belongs to God. This, however, was not the full meaning in the ancient commentaries of the rabbis. For to return something to the earth was to return it to the support, to the substance, to the great matrix, to the firmest and most enduring of all things. And in their speculations, the Kabbalists sought to reverse the form or pattern of the world. They considered space to be the true earth. That actually man, as the tree of the Sephiroths, was an inverted tree. And that in reality and substance, the true earth, as the alchemists also taught, is invisible. For the true earth is simply the infinite area of existence, law, being. This tremendous earth factor tells us definitely that every compound must truly be dissolved, and that everything that is controlled by law escapes law only by its own disintegration. The moment the pattern is no longer present, the law ceases to be manifested. And as Buddha points out, when all laws cease to manifest, then the nirvana is achieved. All conflict between a structure and principle has been overcome. In this same concept, therefore, deity is now presented in a slightly different situation. And we begin to sense the significance of the messianic factor in its relationship to law. We have a polarity now consisting of the Ancient of Ancients, being, and the Torah, existence. And when being and existence unite, they produce creation. But what is the only begotten of the Father? What is this mysterious something that arises also in the union of God and the law? in all the Greek and other classical schools of philosophy, there was this mysterious being corresponding in the Sephirothic system of the Kabbalists with the point of Deyath, where the vertical and horizontal bars of the tree cross. This mysterious other beingness that comes into existence, the Son of Man and the Son of God, the mysterious messianic power is there and is present as an intercessor between being and existence. An intercessor between the inevitable of the divine will and the inevitable of the immutable law, and the inevitable that these two shall conflict. This principle is not compromise. It is a principle of mediation. It is the Gnostic aeon of the Sota, which stands glorified between the Ancient One and the splendid form of the Virgin Sophia. Again, the Mother of Mysteries. In this struggle, then, between man, let's say again now, as his will to create, and man as laws operating through every bone, sinew, and nerve of his body, which cannot be violated, there has to be some kind of a middle ground here. The ancients regarded this as the soul, the firstborn of heaven and earth. And the psychic factor has still remained essentially a mystery. And in the Kabbalah, the mystery of the soul was given a great deal of a very patient consideration. But being naturalists by their general thinking, and rather practical people in spite of their broad abstractions, the Kabbalists took a simple example from their own way of life. Here is an individual, a consciousness we call man. Here is, we will say, resistance. Force, power, will, energy, meeting resistance. The resistance of circumstance, or on the higher level, the resistance of violated law. For when man violated the law, Torah rose in anger to the face of the Great One and demanded that the lawbreaker receive appropriate punishment. Just, of course, as Juno was forever plaguing old Jupiter, and no one was quite able to make out the meaning of the legends. Between, therefore, a consciousness and the immutability of law, a pattern was set up. This pattern was created for the primary purpose of bridging or reconciling the opposites. This pattern must be the immortal mortal, must be the world hero, must partake of consciousness, yet also must share in the mysterious mortality of the law. This being must achieve its strange position through experience. Here we have the two great powers abiding together: God as being, the Torah as law, each from the vast pinnacle of its own aloofness, pouring its resources upon the mystery of creation. Yet the solution to the mystery, the ultimate solving of the riddle, is only possible to some creature that stands in the midst of creation itself. and therefore experiences in itself the operations of these two sovereign powers. The purpose of this concept was that man should occupy that place, that man should worship God and keep the law. In this sense, however, a kind of archetypal man was devised. For man himself, as a principle of equilibrium, must also bear witness to the chemical compound of will and law. This mysterious power of mingling of will and law produced what Bemi termed the great patience, the strange power of the waiting, that which patiently and inevitably overcomes the mystery of the struggle between consciousness and law. And this mystery is the psychic integration of mind and emotion. For by mind, man seeks to conceive of the nature of God. And by emotion, participate in the inevitability of law. Therefore, man may feel the law, and he may know the God. And out of the blending of feeling and emotion, feeling and thought, therefore was created a psychic entity, an experiencing mind, the mind of the great pity, the mind that was aware of the sorrows caused in the confusion of the middle distance, the mystery of the aeon that died for the aeons in the Gnostic philosophy. This problem then becomes the next essential secret of the Kabbalistic system. And that is the one that we have to take up next time when we will go into the problem of Michael and Metatron, the angel of the face. And so I guess that's about all for this evening.